Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents the Night Angel Trilogy, Beyond the Shadows Part 1. Created by Brent Weeks. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Eric Messner, Laura Quinn Anderson, Ren Casey, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Michael Glenn, Terrence Azelford, Tim Getman, M.B. Van Dorn, Elizabeth Jernigan, Rick Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Johan Detweiler, Tony Penny, Joe Brack, Casey Platt, Nanette Savard, Lily Beacon, Mort Shelby, James Lewis, Scott McCormick, and Yasmin Toison. Beyond the Shadows, Part 1. Logan Geyer was sitting in the mud and blood of the battlefield of Pavel's Grove when Tara Grayson came to him. It was barely an hour since they'd routed the Caladorans, when the monstrous Ferali forged to devour Sonaria's army had turned instead on its Caladoran masters. Logan had issued the orders that seemed most pressing, then dismissed everyone to join the revelries that were sweeping the Sonarian camp. Tara Grayson came to him alone. He was sitting on a low rock, heedless of the mud. His fine clothes were so spattered with blood and worse that they were a total loss anyway. Tara's dress, by contrast, was clean except for the lower fringe. She wore high-heeled shoes, but even those couldn't keep her entirely free of the thick mud. She stopped before him. He didn't stand. She pretended not to notice. He pretended not to notice that her bodyguards, unbloodied from battle, were hidden in the trees less than 100 paces away. Tara Grayson could have only one reason to come to him. She was wondering if she was still the queen.
You were a hero today. You stopped the God King's beast. They're saying you killed him.
No.
You commanded it to destroy our enemies, and it did. You saved Sonaria.
Logan shrugged. It already seemed long ago.
I guess the question is, did you save Sonaria for yourself, or for all of us?
Don't give me that horse shit, Tara. You think you're going to manipulate me? Got nothing to offer, nothing to threaten. You've got a question for me? Have a little respect and just fucking ask.
Tara's back stiffened, her chin lifted, and one hand twitched, but then she stopped. It was the hand twitch that captured Logan's attention. If she had raised her hand, was that the sign for her men to attack? Logan looked past her into the woods at the edge of the field, but the first thing he saw wasn't her men. He saw his own, Agon's dogs, including two of the astoundingly talented archers Agon had armed with Yumuri bows and made witch hunters, had stealthily circled behind Tara's bodyguards. Both witch hunters had arrows knocked, but not drawn. Both men had obviously taken care to stand where Logan could see them clearly, because none of the other dogs were clearly visible. One archer was alternately looking at Logan and at a target in the woods. Logan followed his eyes and saw Tara's hidden archer aiming at Logan, waiting for Tara's signal. The other witch hunter was staring at Tara Grayson's back. They were waiting for Logan's signal. Logan should have known his streetwise followers wouldn't leave him alone when Tara Grayson was near.
You swore fealty to me this morning under less than ideal circumstances. Do you intend to keep your oath, or do you intend to make yourself king?
Logan thought he'd already made his decision, but he hesitated. He remembered how it felt to be powerless in the hole, how it felt to be powerless when Janine, his just-wed wife, had been murdered. He remembered how disconcertingly wonderful it felt to tell Kyler to kill Gorky and see it done. He wondered if he would feel the same pleasure at seeing Tara Grayson die. With one nod toward those witch hunters, he would find out. He would never feel powerless again. His father had told him,
"An oath is the measure of the man who gives it."
Logan had seen what happened when he did what he knew was right, no matter how foolish it looked at the time. That was what rallied the holers around him. That was what had saved his life when he was feverish and barely conscious. That was what had made Lily, the woman the Caladorans crafted into the Ferali, turn on the Caladorans. Ultimately, Logan's doing what was right had saved all of Sonaria. But his father, Regnus Drake, had lived by his oaths through a miserable marriage and miserable service to a petty, wicked king. He gritted his teeth all day and slept well every night. Logan didn't know if he was as much of a man as his father. He couldn't do it. So he hesitated. If she raised her hand to order her men to attack, she would be breaking the covenant between lord and vassal. If she broke it, he would be free.
Our soldiers proclaim me king. Lose your temper, Terra. Order the attack. Order your own death.
Men say many things in the heat of battle. I am prepared to forgive this indiscretion.
Is this what Kyla saved me for? No. But this is the man I am. I am my father's son.
Logan stood slowly so as not to alarm either side's archers. Then, slowly, he knelt and touched Terra Grayson's feet in submission. Late that night, a band of Kalidorans attacked the Sonarian camp, killing dozens of drunken revelers before fleeing into the darkness. In the morning, Terra Grayson sent Logan Geyer and 1,000 of his men to hunt them down. The sentry was a seasoned Sakurai, a sword lord who'd killed 16 men and bound their forelocks into his fiery red hair. His eyes probed the darkness, restlessly, where the forest and the oak grove met, and when he turned, he shielded his eyes from his comrade's low fires to protect his night vision. He wore no helmet that would muffle his hearing, but he had no chance of stopping the wet boy.
Former wet boy.
Kyla balanced one hand on a broad oak limb. If he were still a killer for hire, he'd murder the sentry and be done with it. Kyla was something different now. The Night Angel. Immortal. Invisible. And nearly invincible. And he only served death to those who deserved it. These swordsmen from the land whose very name meant the sword, Kura, were the best soldiers Kyler had ever seen. They had set up camp with efficiency that spoke of years of campaigning. They cleared brush that might conceal the approach of enemies, banked their small fires to reduce their visibility, and arranged their tents to protect their horses and their leaders. Each fire warmed 10 men, each of whom clearly knew his responsibilities. They moved like ants in the forest, and once they finished their duties, each man would wander only as far as an adjacent fire. They gambled, but they didn't drink. The only snag in all the Curran's efficiency seemed to come from their armor. With Curran bamboo and lacquer armor, a man could dress himself. But donning the Kalidoran armor they had stolen a week ago at Pavel's Grove required assistance. Scale mail mixed with chain and even plate, and the Currans couldn't decide if they needed to sleep armored or if men should be assigned to each other as squires. When each squad was allowed to decide for itself how to fix the problem and didn't waste time asking up the chain of command, Kyla knew his friend Logan Geyer was doomed. War leader Lantano Garawashi paired the Curran love of order with individual responsibility. It was emblematic of why Garawashi had never lost a fight. It was why he had to die. So Kyler moved through the trees like the breath of a vengeful god. The oaks grew in straight, widely spaced rows broken where younger trees had muscled between their elder shoulders and grown ancient themselves. Kyla climbed out as far on a limb as he could and spied Lantano Garawashi through the swaying branches, dimly illuminated in the light of his fire, touching the sword in his lap with the delight of recent acquisition. If Kyla could get to the next oak, he could climb down mere paces from his debtor.
Can I still call my target a debtor? Even though I'm not a wet boy anymore? Well, I can't really call him a target, can I?
Assassins have targets, because assassins sometimes miss.
Kyla gauged the distance to the next limb that could bear his weight. 8 paces. It was no great leap. The daunting part was landing on a tree limb and arresting his momentum silently with only one arm. If Kyla didn't leap, he'd have to sneak between 2 fires where men were still passing intermittently, and the ground was strewn with dead leaves. He'd jump, he decided, when the next good breeze came.
There's an odd light in your eyes.
Lantano Garawashi was big for a Curran. Tall and lean and as heavily muscled as a tiger. Stripes of his own hair, burning the same color as the flickering fire, were visible through the 60 locks of all colors he'd claimed from opponents he'd killed.
I've always loved fire. I want to remember it as I die.
Kylo shifted to get a look at the speaker. It was Fir Kasat, a blonde mountain of a man as wide as he was tall. Kylo had met him once. Fir was not only a capable hand with a sword, he was a mage. Kylo was lucky the man's back was to him. A week ago, after the Kaladoran god king Garath Ursul killed him, Kylo had made a bargain with the yellow-eyed being called the Wolf. In his weird lair in the lands between life and death, the Wolf promised to restore Kylo's right arm and bring him back to life quickly if Kylo stole Lantano Garawashi's sword. What had seemed simple, who can stop an invisible man from stealing, was getting more complicated by the second. Who can stop an invisible man? A man who can see invisible men.
So, you really believe the Dark Hunter lives in those woods?
Draw the blade a little, war leader.
Garawashi bared the sword a hand's breadth. Light poured from a blade that looked like a crystal filled with fire.
The blade burns to warn of danger or magic. The Dark Hunter is both.
So am I.
It's close.
Lantano rose to a crouch like a tiger ready to pounce.
I told you, Lauren, the Cenarian army here might be our deaths, not theirs.
For the past week, since the Battle of Pavel's Grove, Garawashi had led Logan and his men east. Because the Kurans had disguised themselves in dead Kaladoran's armor, Logan thought he was chasing the remnants of the defeated Kaladoran army. Kylo still had no idea why Lantano Garawashi had led Logan here.
You said we were safe as long as we didn't go into the Hunter's Wood.
I said probably safe. The Hunter senses and hates magic. That sword definitely counts.
We didn't go into the Hunter's Woods. And if the Cenarians want to fight us, they must.
As Kylo finally understood the plan, he could hardly breathe. The woods north, south, and west of the grove were thick and overgrown. The only way for Logan to use his numerical superiority would be to come through the east, where the giant sequoias of the Dark Hunter's Wood gave an army plenty of space to maneuver. But it was said a creature from ages past killed anything that entered that wood. Learned men scoffed at such superstition, but Kylo had met the peasants of Taurus Bend. If they were superstitious, they were a people with only one superstition. Logan would march right into the trap. Kylo snarled silently and leapt. With his talent, he made the distance easily, but he jumped too hard, too far, and he slipped off the far side of the branch. Little black talons jabbed through his clothing along the sides of his knees, along his left forearm, and even from his ribs. For a moment, the talons were liquid metal, and then they solidified and Kylo jerked to a stop. After he pulled himself back onto the branch, the claws melted back into his skin. Kylo was left trembling, and not just because of how close he'd come to falling.
What am I becoming?
With every death reaped and every death suffered, he was growing stronger. It scared the hell out of him.
What does it cost? There's got to be a price.
Gritting his teeth, Kylo climbed headfirst down the tree, letting the claws rise and sink from his skin, stabbing little holes in his clothes and in the tree bark. When he reached the ground, the Black Akari bled from every pore to cover him like a second skin. Invisible, Kylo advanced.
I dreamed of living in a small town like that Taurus Bend. Build a smithy on the river. Design a water wheel to drive the bellows until my sons are old enough to help. A prophet told me it could happen.
Bane of your dreams. My main army should be almost through the mountains. You and I are going.
Main army? The last piece clicked. This was why the Sakurai had dressed as Kaladorans. Garawashi had drawn the best of Cenaria's army far to the east, while his main army was massing in the west. With the Kaladorans defeated at Pavel's Grove, Cenaria's peasant levies were probably already hurrying back to their farms. In days, a couple hundred Cenarian castle guards were going to face the entire Kuran army.
Going? Tonight? Now!
Garawashi smirked right at Kylo. Kylo froze. But he saw no flash of recognition in those green eyes. Instead, he saw something worse. There were 82 kills in Garawashi's eyes. 82. And not one of them a murder. Killing Lantano Garawashi wouldn't be justice. It would be murder.
Damn.
From Tamagarawashi jumped to his feet, the scabbard flying from a sword that looked like a bar of flame, his body already in a fighting stance. The mountain that was fear was only a little slower. He was on his feet, turning with naked steel in his hand faster than Kylo would have believed from a man so big. His eyes went wide as he saw Kylo. Kylo let blue flame whoosh over the Kakari skin and the great frowning mask he wore. One of Garawashi's bodyguards attacked from behind. Kylo's talent surged and he backflipped, planting his feet on the man's shoulders and pushing off. The Sakurai smashed into the ground, and Kylo flipped through the air, blue flames whipping and crackling from his body. Before he caught the branch, he dropped the flames and went invisible. He flipped from branch to branch, one-handed with no attempt at stealth. If he didn't do something tonight, Logan and all his men would die.
Was that the Hunter?
Worse, that was the Night Angel. Perhaps the only man in the world you need fear.
Lantano Garawashi's eyes lit with a fire that told fear he heard the words, "Man, you need fear," as worthy adversary.
Which way did he go?
As Aline rode up to the little inn in Taurus Bend, utterly exhausted, a gorgeous young woman with long red hair and a ponytail and an earring sparkling in her left ear was mounting a roan stallion. The stable hand ogled her as she rode north. Aline was almost on top of the stable hand before the man turned. He blinked at her stupidly.
Hey! Your friend just left.
What are you talking about?
You can still catch her.
Aline had seen the young woman well enough to know that they'd never met. She shook her head. She had to pick up supplies in Taurus Bend before she headed to Sonaria. Besides, it was almost dark, and after her days on the trail with her Caladoran captors, Aline needed a night in bed and desperately needed a chance to wash up.
I don't think so.
She went inside, rented a room from the distracted innkeeper's wife with some of the generous amount of silver she'd found in her horse's saddlebags, washed herself and her filthy clothing, and immediately fell asleep. Before dawn, she pulled on her still damp dress distastefully and went downstairs. The innkeeper, a slight young man, was carrying in a crate full of washed flagons from outside and setting them upside down to dry before he finally went to bed for the night. He nodded at Aline in a friendly manner, barely glancing up.
The wife will have breakfast ready in half an hour. And if... Oh, well...
The man looked at her again, obviously seeing her for the first time.
Moira didn't tell me.
He rubbed his hands on his apron in what was obviously a habitual gesture, because his hands weren't wet, and stalked over to a table piled high with knick-knacks, notes, and account books. He pulled out a note and handed it to her apologetically.
I didn't see you last night, or I'd have given it to you straight away.
Aline's name and description were written on the outside of the note. She unfolded it, and a smaller, crumpled note fell out. The smaller note was in Kyler's hand. It was dated the day he'd left her in Caernarvon. Her throat tightened.
Aline, I'm sorry. I tried. I swear I tried. Some things are worth more than my happiness. Some things only I can do. Sell these to Master Bureri, and move the family to a better part of town. I will always love you.
Kylo still loved her. He loved her. She'd always believed it, but it was different to see it in his own messy writing. She didn't even care about the disconcerted innkeeper, opening and shutting his mouth, unsure what to do with a woman crying in his inn. Aline had refused to change, and it had cost her everything. But the god was giving her a second chance. She'd show Kylo just how strong, deep, and wide a woman's love could be. It wasn't going to be easy, but he was the man she loved. He was the one. She loved him, and it was as simple as that. It was several minutes before she read the other note, this one written in an unfamiliar woman's hand.
My name's Vi. I'm the wet boy who killed Jarl and kidnapped Yuli. Kylar left you to save Logan and kill the God King. The man you loved saved Sonaria. I hope you're proud of him. If you go to Sonaria, I've given Mama Kay access to my accounts for you. Take whatever you want. Otherwise, Yuli will be at the Chantry as will I. And I think Kyler will go there soon. There's more, but I can't bear to write it. I had to do something terrible so we could win. No words can erase what I've done to you. I'm so terribly sorry. I wish that I could make it right, but I can't. When you come, you can exact whatever vengeance you wish, even to my life. V. Savari.
The hairs on the back of Aline's neck were standing up. What kind of person would claim to be such an enemy and a friend? Where were Aline's wedding earrings?
There's more, but I can't bear to write it.
What did that mean? V had done something terrible. The lead weight of intuition dropped into Aline's stomach. The woman outside yesterday had been wearing an earring. It probably wasn't. It surely wasn't.
Oh, my God.
The dream was different every night. Logan stood on the platform looking at pretty, petty Tara Grayson. She would walk over an army of corpses or marry a man she despised to seize her ambition. As it had that day, Logan's heart failed him. His father had married a woman who poisoned all his happiness. Logan could not. As he had that day, Logan asked for her fealty, the round platform reminding him of the hole where he'd rotted during the Caladoran occupation. Tara refused. But instead of submitting himself so the armies wouldn't be split on the eve of battle, Logan spoke.
Then I sentence you to death for treason.
Tara stumbled back too slowly. The blade cut halfway through her neck. Logan caught her, and abruptly, it was another woman, another police. Janine's slashed throat gushed blood over her white nightgown and his bare chest. The Caladorans who'd broken into the wedding chamber were there. Logan thrashed and woke. He lay in darkness. It took him time to reorient himself. His Janine was dead. Tara Grayson was queen. Logan had sworn fealty. Logan Geyer had given his troth, a word that meant just not his oath, but his truth. So if his queen ordered him to stamp out the last few Caladorans, he complied. He would always be glad to kill Caladorans. Sitting up in the dark of the camp tent, Logan saw the captain of his bodyguards, Caldrosa Wynn.
It's time.
General Brant Agon poked his head in the tent, then entered. He still needed two canes to walk.
The scouts have returned. Our elite Caladorans think they're setting an ambush. If we come from the north, south, or west, we have to go through dense forest. The only way is through the Hunter's Wood. If it really exists, it'll wipe us out. If I were facing 1,400 men with only 100, I don't think I could do any better.
If the situation had arisen a month ago, Logan wouldn't have hesitated. He would lead his army through the open spaces of the Hunter's Wood. Legends be damned. But at Pavel's Grove, they'd seen a legend walk and devour thousands. The Ferali had shaken Logan's conviction that he knew the difference between superstition and reality.
They're Caladoran. Why didn't they head north for Korix Pass?
Agon shrugged. It was a week-old problem. This platoon wasn't nearly as sloppy as the Caladorans they knew. Even as they fled from Logan's army, they'd raided. Sonaria had lost 100 men. The Caladorans hadn't lost one. The best guess Agon could make was that they were an elite unit from some Caladoran tribe the Sonarians hadn't encountered before. Logan felt like he was staring at a puzzle. If he didn't solve it, his people would die.
You still want to hit them from all sides?
Yes.
Are you still insisting on leading the cavalry through the wood yourself?
Logan nodded. If he was going to ask men to brave death from some monster, he would do it himself, too.
That's very brave.
Enough! Let's go kill some Caladorans.
Brudmeister Nefdada spat the results of his unhealthy coughing into his hand. Then he tilted his hand and watched the phlegm drip to the dirt before turning his eyes to the other Brudmeisters around his low fire. Aside from the young Borsini, who blinked incessantly, they gave no sign that he disgusted them. A man didn't survive long enough to become a Würdmeister on magical strength alone. Glowing faintly, figures were laid out in military formations on the ground.
This is only an estimation of the army's positions. Logan Geyer's forces are in red, roughly 1,400 men, west of the Dark Hunter's Wood, in Cenarian lands. Maybe 200 Currents, pretending to be Caledoran, are the blue, right at the edge of the wood. Further south, in white, are 5,000 of our beloved enemies, the Lycanoct. We Caledorans haven't fought the Lycanoct directly since you were all still at the Tit. So, let me remind you that though they hate all magic, we are what they were created to destroy. 5,000 of them is more than enough to complete the job the Cenarians began at the Battle of Pavel's Grove. So, we must tread carefully.
In quick detail, Neff outlined what he knew of the deployment of all the forces, inventing details where it seemed appropriate, and always speaking over the Würdmeister's heads, as if expecting them to understand intricacies of generalship that they had never learned. Whenever a God King died, the massacres began. First, the heirs turned on each other. Then the survivors rallied Meisters and Würdmeisters around them and began anew, until only one Ursul remained. If no one established dominance quickly, the bloodletting would spread to the Meisters. Neff didn't intend for that to happen. So as soon as he was certain that God King Gareth Ursul was dead, Neff had found Tensor Ursul, one of the God King's heirs, and convinced the boy to carry Kali. Tensor thought carrying the goddess would mean power. It would for Neff. For Tensor, it meant catatonia and insanity. Then, Neff had sent a simple message to Würdmeisters at every corner of the Caledoran Empire.
Help me bring Kali home.
By answering a religious call, every Würdmeister who didn't want to throw away his life backing some vicious Ursul child had a legitimate escape. And if Neff tamed these first Würdmeisters who derived from their postings in nearby lands, when Würdmeisters arrived from the rest of the Empire, they too would fall in line. If there was one thing God Kings were good at, it was inculcating submission.
The Dark Hunter's Wood is between us and all these armies.
Neff motioned to encompass the Würdmeisters himself and Kali's bodyguard, a bare 50 men in all.
I personally have seen over 100 men, Meisters and not, ordered into the wood. None has emerged. Ever. If this were merely a matter of Kali's security, I would not bring this to your attention.
Neff's coughing was calculated, too. Those who wouldn't bend the knee to a young man might be content to bide their time serving a failing old one.
The Currens have the sword of power, Kurok, right there.
Neff gestured to where his phlegm had fallen at the very edge of the Dark Hunter's Wood.
Has the sword taken the form of Kurren Kalestos, the Kurren's blade of heaven?
Würdmeister Borsini was the young, blinking one with a grotesquely large nose and big ears to match. He was staring into the distance. Neff didn't like it. Had Borsini been eavesdropping when the scout reported?
Kurok takes any shape it pleases. The point is, if Kurok goes into the Hunter's Wood, it will never come out. We have a slim chance to seize a prize we've sought for ages.
But there are three armies here. All outnumber us, and each would happily kill us.
Attempting to claim the sword will most likely end in death. But may I remind you, Taras, if we don't try, we will answer for it. Therefore, I will go. I am old. I have few years remaining to me, so my death will cost the Empire less.
Who's put you in charge?
Kali has. Kali has sent me a vision. That's why I asked that the Currens call the sword. Kali told me that I am to fetch the Kur Kalestos. I am the youngest of us, the most dispensable and the fastest. Würdmeister Dada, she said she will speak to you this morning. You are to await her word by the prince's bedside. Alone.
The boy was a genius. Borsini wanted a chance at the sword, and he was buying off Neff in front of all of them. Neff would stay with Kali and the catatonic prince, and when he emerged, it would be with a word from the goddess. In truth, Neff hadn't wanted to go after the sword at all. But the only way he was certain the others would make him stay was if he'd tried to go. Orsini's eyes met Neff's.
If I get the sword, you serve me. Understood?
Blessed be her name.
The Circle didn't fully understand what had just happened. They would in time.
You should take my horse. It's faster than yours.
And Neff had woven a small cantrip into its mane. When the sun rose, at about the time a rider would get to the south side of the wood, the cantrip would begin pulsing with magic that would draw the dark hunter. Orsini wouldn't live to see noon.
Thank you, but I'm an awkward hand at new horses. I'll take my own.
Neff blinked as if disappointed and then shrugged as if to cover and say it didn't matter. It didn't. He'd tied that cantrip into the mane of every horse in the camp. Kyler had never started a war. Approaching the Lycanot camp required none of the stealth he'd used to approach the Currens. Invisible, he simply walked past the sentries in their black tabards, emblazoned with a golden sun, the pure light of reason beating back the darkness of superstition. Kyler grinned. The Lycanot were going to love the Night Angel. The camp was huge. It held an entire legion, 5,000 soldiers, including 1,000 of the famed Lycanot Lancers. As a purely ideological society, the Lycanot claimed they held no land. In practice, they'd occupied Eastern Cenaria for 18 years. Kyler suspected this legion had been sent here as a show of force to deter Kalidor from trying to push further east. Maybe they just happened to be here. In truth, he didn't care. The Lycanot were bullies. If there had been a shred of integrity in their claim of fighting black magic, they would have come to Cenaria's defense when Kalidor invaded. Instead, they bided their time, burning local witches, and recruiting among the Cenarian refugees. They'd probably been hoping to come to the rescue after Cenaria's power was obliterated and take even better lands for their pains. Without provoking anyone, Cenaria had been invaded from the east by the Lycanot, from the north by Kalidor, and now from the south by Kura. It was about time some of those hungry swords met each other. A smoking black blade slid from Kyler's left hand. He made it glow, wreathed in blue flames, but kept himself invisible. Two soldiers chatting instead of walking their patrol routes froze at the sight. The first one was a relative innocent. In the other's eyes, Kyler could see that the man had accused a miller of witchcraft because he wanted the man's wife. The man looked down, then touched his split face where blood gushed, and his entrails spurted out. The other sentry bolted. Kyler ran, pulling his illusions around him. He ran past a knot of gaunt Cenarian recruits, wide-eyed at the sight of him, weapons in hand but forgotten. There were no crimes in their eyes. These men had joined because they had no other way to feed themselves. The next group had participated in 100 burnings and worse. He slid the Kakari sword through the man's loins. It would be a bad death. Three more died before anyone attacked him. He danced past the spear and loped off its head. He kept running for the command tents at the center of the camp. Finally, he found what he was looking for. An older man burst out of the largest tent in the camp. He threw a great helmet on his head, the symbol of a Lycanot underlord, a general.
Form up! Hedgehog! You fools! You're being beguiled! Hedgehog formation, damn you!
Kyler saw men starting to form loose circles of 10 with their backs to each other, spears out.
You're only fighting yourselves! It's a delusion! Remember your armor!
The Underlord meant the armor of unbelief. The Lycanot thought superstitions only had power if you believed in them. Kyler leapt high into the air and let himself become visible as he dropped in front of the Underlord. He landed on one knee, his left hand to the ground, holding the sword, his head bowed. Though the cacophony continued in the distance, the men nearby were stunned to silence.
Underlord, for you I bear a message.
It is nothing but an apparition! Gava! Eagle 3!
Blue flames leaped from the Night Angel's mouth and eyes.
You Larkanaut fools! This land is Caledoran now. Flee or be slaughtered. Flee or face judgment.
By claiming to be Caledoran, Kylo hoped to draw any backlash onto the Kurans disguised as Caledorans who were trying to kill Logan and all his men.
Delusions have no power over us! Remember your armor, men! It cannot cut us! The light is ours! We do not fear the darkness!
I judge you. I find you wanting.
Kylo faded completely and saw relief in every eye around the circle. Some men and women openly grinned and shook their heads, amazed but victorious. The Underlord's aide-de-camp led his horse to him and handed him the reins and his lance. He mounted, looking like he knew he needed to start giving orders, reasserting control, getting the men to act so they wouldn't think, so they wouldn't panic. Kylo waited until he opened his mouth. A soldier toppled to the ground. This time, the sword appeared only as it jutted out of the soldier's back. The man was lifted off the ground and flung headlong into the side of the iron cauldron.
Torturer!
Wreathed in blue flames that whipped and crackled in long streams behind him, Kylo was already flipping clear of the circle. Staying visible and burning, he ran straight north, as if heading back to the Caledoran camp. Men dove out of its path. Then Kylo extinguished the flames, went invisible, and came back to see if his trap had worked.
Form up! We march to the forest! It's time to kill the witches, men! Let's go! Now!
You're next to the left!
The Caledoran was so muscular he looked like a sack full of nuts. But the most noticeable lump was the wen bulging grotesquely from his forehead.
Hey, Hoffman! That means you!
Dorian shuffled into the line on the left, tearing his eyes away from the guard. He knew the man. A bastard who'd been whelped on some slave girl by one of Dorian's older brothers. The Aethlings. The throne-worthy sons had tormented Rugger unrelentingly. Dorian's tutor, Nefdada, encouraged it. There was just one rule. They couldn't do harm to any slave that would keep him from performing his duties.
You staring at something?
Dorian looked resolutely at the floor and shook his head. He'd altered his appearance as much as he dared before coming to the Citadel to ask for work, but he couldn't take any illusion too far. He would be beaten regularly. A guard or noble or Aethling would notice if a blow didn't hit the proper resistance or if Dorian didn't flinch appropriately. He'd experimented with altering the balance of his humors so that he might stop growing a man's hair, too. But the results had been horrifying. He touched his chest, now mercifully back to male proportions, just thinking about it. Instead, he'd practiced until he could sweep his body with fire and air so as to be hairless. With the speed his beard came in, it would be a weave he would have to use twice a day. A slave's life included little privacy, so speed was essential. Mercifully, slaves were beneath notice, as long as they didn't draw attention to themselves by staring at guards as if they were freaks. Slouch or die, Dorian. Rugger smacked him again, but Dorian didn't move, so Rugger moved down the line to harass others. They were standing outside the bridge keep. 200 men and women were at the keep's west gate. Winter was coming, and even those who'd had good harvests had been beggared by the God King's armies. For the small folk, it hardly mattered if the army passing through was enemy or friend. One looted, the other scavenged, but each took what it wanted and killed anyone who resisted. With the God King emptying the Citadel to send armies both south into Sanaria and north into the Freeze, the coming winter would be brutal. All the people in the line were hoping to sell themselves into slavery before winter arrived and the lines quadrupled. It was an icy clear autumn morning in the city of Kaliras, 2 hours before dawn. Dorian had forgotten the glory of the northern stars. In the city, few lamps burned. Oil was too precious. So few terrestrial fires tried to compete with the ethereal flames burning like holes in the cloak of heaven. Despite himself, Dorian couldn't help but feel a stirring of pride as he looked out over the city that could have been his. Kaliras was laid out in an enormous ring around the chasm that surrounded Mount Thrall. Succeeding generations of Ursul god kings had walled in semicircles of the city to protect their slaves and artisans and merchants until all the semicircles of different stone had connected to shield the whole of the city.
You four, go!
Dorian was third of four eunuchs, and all shivered as they approached the precipice. Lux Bridge was one of the wonders of the world, and in all his travels, Dorian had never seen magic to rival it. Without arches, without pillars, the bridge hung like a spider's anchor line for 400 paces between the gatekeep and the citadel of Mount Thrall. The last time he'd crossed Lux Bridge, Dorian had only noticed the brilliance of the magic, sparkling, springy underfoot, coruscating in a thousand colors at every step. Now, he saw nothing but the building blocks to which the magic was anchored. Lux Bridge's mundane materials were not stone, metal, or wood. It was paved with human skulls, and a path wide enough for three horses to pass abreast. New heads had been added to whatever holes had formed over the years. Any Verdmeister, as Masters of the Veer were called after they passed the 10th Shura, could dispel the entire bridge with a word. Dorian even knew the spell, for all the good it did him. What made his stomach knot was that the magic of Luxbridge had been crafted so that Magi, who used the talent rather than the foul veer that Meisters and Verdmeisters used, would automatically be dropped. As perhaps the only person in Mid-Kiru who had been trained as both Meister and Magus, Dorian thought he had a better chance of making the crossing than any other Magus. He'd bought new shoes last night and fitted a lead plate inside each sole. He thought he'd eliminated all traces of southern magic that might cling to him. Unfortunately, there was only one way to find out. Heart thudding, Dorian followed the eunuchs onto Lux Bridge. At his first step, the bridge flared weirdly green, and Dorian felt his feet tingling as Veer reached up around his shoes. An instant later, it stopped, and no one had seen it. Dorian had done it. Lux Bridge felt that he was talented, but Dorian's ancestors had been smart enough to know that not every talented person was a mage. The rest of Dorian's steps, shuffling like the other nervous eunuchs, brought sparks out of the magic that made the embedded skulls seem to yawn and shift as they stared hatefully at those who passed overhead, but they didn't give way. If Dorian felt some pride at the genius of Lux Bridge, the sight of Mount Thrall brought only dread. He'd been born in the bowels of that damned rock, been starved in its dungeons, fought in its pits, and committed murder in its bedchambers and kitchens and halls. Within that mountain, Dorian would find his word, his destiny, his doom, his completion. He would also find the woman who would become his wife. And he feared he would find out why he had cast aside his gift of prophecy. What was so terrible that he wanted to throw away his foreknowledge of it? Mount Thrall was unnatural. An enormous four-sided black pyramid, twice as tall as it was wide, and extending deep below the earth. From Luxbridge, Dorian looked down and saw clouds obscuring whatever depths lay below. 30 generations of slaves, both Caladoran and captured in war, had been sent into those depths, mining until they gasped out their last breaths in the putrid fumes and added their own bones to the ore. The pyramid of the mountain had been sheared straight down one edge and flattened, leaving a plateau in front of a great triangular dagger of mountain. The citadel sat on that plateau. It was dwarfed by the mountain, but as one approached, it became clear that the citadel was a city unto itself. It held barracks for 10,000 soldiers, great storerooms, vast cisterns, training places for men and horses and wolves, armories, a dozen smithies, kitchens, stables, barns, stockyards, lumberyards, and space for all the workers, tools, and raw materials needed for 20,000 people to survive a year under siege. And even at that, the citadel was dwarfed in comparison to the castle that was Mount Thrall. For the mountain was honeycombed with halls and great rooms and apartments and dungeons and passages long forgotten that bored into its very roots. Neither the citadel nor the mountain had been full in decades, and with the army sent north and south, the place was even quieter than usual. Kaleras was now home to only the small folk, a skeleton crew of an army, less than half of the kingdom's meisters, enough functionaries to keep the reduced business of the kingdom operating, the Aethlings, and the God King's wives and concubines and their keepers. Head among those keepers was the chief eunuch, Yorbus Zurga. Yorbus was an old, soft, perfectly hairless man, even shaving his head and plucking his eyebrows and eyelashes. He sat huddled in an ermine cloak to ward off the morning chill at the servant's gate. Before him was a desk with a parchment unrolled on it. His blue eyes studied Dorian dubiously.
You're short.
Yes, my lord.
Sir will suffice.
Yes, sir.
You have an odd look about you.
In his youth, Dorian had rarely seen Yorba Zurga. He didn't think the man would remember him. But anything that caused greater scrutiny was dangerous.
Do you know the penalty for a man who attempts entry into the harem?
Dorian shook his head and looked steadfastly at the ground. He clenched his jaw and, without raising his eyes, tucked his hair back behind his ears. It was what he considered a stroke of genius. He'd given himself silver streaks in his hair paired with slightly pointed ears and several webbed toes. They were features that only one tribe in Kalidor possessed. The Fiuri claimed to be descended from the Fae folk and were equally despised for that and their pacifism. Dorian appeared to be half Fiuri, which was exotic enough and from a group despised enough that he hoped no one would stop to think how his Kalidoran half made him look a lot like Garrath or Sul. It also explained why he was short.
It's the other reason they call me Halfman, sir.
I see. Then here are the terms of your indenture. You will serve whatever hours are asked of you. Your first tasks will include emptying and cleaning the concubine's chamber pots. Your food will be cold and never as much as you like. You are forbidden to speak with the concubines, and if you have trouble with this, your tongue will be torn out. You understand?
Dorian nodded.
Then only one thing remains, Halfman.
Sir?
We have to make sure you're half a man after all. Remove your trousers.
Lantano Garawashi sat in Kyla's path, his sword naked across his lap. Mountainous Fir Kasat stood beside him, meat slab arms folded. They blocked a narrow game trail that led along the southern edge of the Hunter's Wood.
The Angel of the Night approaches.
Garawashi's sword was unmistakable. The hilt was long enough for one or two hands. Pure Mysteril, inscribed with gold runes in old Curran. The slightly curving blade was inscribed with a dragon's head facing the tip of the blade. As Kyla came closer, the dragon breathed fire. The flames traveled within the blade, and before them, Cor Kalestas turned clear as glass. The flames rolled out farther as Kyler approached. Kyler brought the Kakari to his eyes and saw Cor Kalestas in the hues of magic. That was when he knew the sword was the product of another age. The magics themselves had been crafted to be beautiful, and Kyler couldn't understand the least of them. He sensed playfulness, grandeur, hauteur, and love.
Drop the shadows, Kyler, or I'll help you drop them.
So, mages can see me when I'm invisible.
Only 1 in 10 men. 9 in 10 women. I can only see you within 30 paces. Dorian could have seen you half a mile away through trees. But I forget myself. Baronet Kyler Stern of Cenaria, also known as the Night Angel, war son of Wetboy Durzo Blint, This is War Leader Lontano Garawashi, the Undefeated, the Chosen of Kor Kalestos, of the Ainu Heights Lontanos.
Kyla clasped his left hand to his stump and bowed in the Kurin style.
War Leader, the many tales of your deeds attest your prowess.
Garawashi rose and slid Kor Kalestos into its sheath. He bowed, and his mouth twitched.
Night Angel, likewise the few tales of yours.
The horizon was brightening, but it was still dark in the forest. It smelled like rain and coming winter. Kyla wondered if they would be the last smells he would experience. He smiled on the rising tide of despair.
They seem to have a problem.
What's that?
You have a sword I need.
Are you out of Forgive me, Night Angel, but you're not left-handed and you move like the loss of your sword hand was recent. Now, if you so desire death that you would challenge me, I will not deny you. But why would you?
Because I made a deal with the wolf.
Make no deals with the wolf.
I can't win.
Not unless I give you a hand.
The black metal ball that lived within Kyla spoke rarely, and it wasn't always helpful when it did.
You're hilarious.
Kawashi's eyes flicked down to Kyla's wrist. Fear was a god. Kyla glanced down and saw jet black metal writhing from his stump. It resolved itself slowly into a hand. He tried to make a fist, and it did.
Are you joking? I'm not that cruel. By the way, Joris and Alcestis didn't like the idea of his enemies coming back to life. If that sword kills you, you're really dead.
Funny, the wolf failed to mention that.
Kyla wiggled the black fingers. He even had some sensation in them. At the same time, the hand was too light. It was hollow, the skin thinner than parchment.
Hey, while you're doing miracles...
No.
You didn't even listen.
Go ahead.
Can you fix its weight?
No.
Why not?
I stay one size. I'm already covering all your skin and making a hand for you. Invisibility, blue flames, and an extra hand not enough for you?
So making a dagger of you and throwing it would be a bad idea.
Kyla grinned. Then he realized he was grinning at Lontano Garawashi, who had 63 deaths tied to his hair and 82 in his eyes.
You need a minute!
I'm ready now.
Kyler, what are you going to do with the sword?
I'm going to put it somewhere safe.
You're taking it into the wood?
I was thinking I'd throw it in.
Good idea.
Perhaps a nice idea, but not a good one.
He could have killed Kyler with that thrust, but he held back, wary of a trap. Kyler staggered back, and Garawashi let him regroup, his eyes showing disappointment. The man was too fast, ridiculously fast.
You're not even talented.
Lontano Garawashi needs no magic!
It began again, Garawashi feeling Kyler out, even giving ground, seeing what Kyler could do. But there was no holding back. Kyler had seen that. Soon Kyler would tire and try something desperate. Something changed on Garawashi's face. It wasn't enough to tell Kyler what he was going to do, but it was enough to tell him that Garawashi thought he knew Kyler's strengths. Now he would end it. Kyler waited for Garawashi to advance. Those damn long arms of his, unbelievably quick, the stance fluid and sure.
You feel it, don't you? The rhythm.
Sometimes. Once, I heard it as music.
Many died that day.
Kyla shrugged.
30 Highlanders, 4 witches, and a Kalidoran prince.
Lontano Garawashi smiled, not surprised at Fear's knowledge.
Yet today you fight woodenly. You're stiff, slower than usual. Do you know why? That day you faced death no less than you do today. Today, you're afraid. It narrows your vision, tenses your muscles, makes you slow. It'll make you dead. Fight to win, Kyler Stern, not to not lose.
It was disconcerting to hear good advice from the man who was about to kill him.
Here.
Garawashi lifted Kor Kalestos, and Kyler saw the edges go blunt.
I'll know when you're ready.
Garawashi attacked again, and within seconds the dull sword scraped Kyler's ribs. But even as the blows rained down on him, Kyler began to remember his master Durzo's merciless sparring. His fear receded. This was the same. Except now Kyler had more endurance, more strength, more speed, and more experience than a year ago. and he'd beaten Durzo. Kylan's vision cleared and his pulse slowed from its frenzied hammering.
Watch a spirit!
Coracolestus went sharp once more, and they began. The fight accelerated, but Kyler felt it calm. He was, he realized, smiling. Madness. Yet it was so. And Garawashi's thin lips were drawn up in a little smirk of their own. There was beauty here, something precious and rare. Every man wished he could fight. Few could, and only one in 100 years fought this well. Kyler had never thought to see another master on a par with Durzo Blint. But Lantano Garawashi might even be better than Durzo. A little faster, his reach a little longer. Kyler dove behind a sapling a second before Garawashi sheared it in two. As Garawashi pushed aside the falling tree, Kyler thought. He only had one thing Lantano Garawashi didn't. Well, aside from invisibility.
No, don't use that. It wouldn't be fair.
What Lantano Garawashi didn't have was years of fighting against someone better than he was. Kyler was studying Garawashi's style in a way Garawashi had never needed study anyone's. It was straightforward. Garawashi basically depended on his superior speed, strength, reach, technique, and flexibility to win. And there. Kyler went through half of Lord Umbra's glut and then modified it, twisting the last parry, so Coracolestus missed his cheek by a breath. His own sword gashed Garawashi's shoulder, but Garawashi's counter was already coming. Kyler threw up an arm and instinctively brought the Kakari up along the ridge. Kyler's arm burned. The warrior staggered back, and Kyler knew that if Garawashi had put any more force into that counter, it would have destroyed the Kakari.
Oh, please, please don't ever do that again.
Who taught you that?
Kyler's left arm was throbbing, bleeding where Coracolestus had scraped it.
He means the combination, Kyler. That move's called Garawashi's turn. No one else is fast enough to do it.
Kyler fell back into a ready stance, not in fear now, but futility. He'd thrown his best at Garawashi and barely scratched him.
No one taught me. It just seemed right.
The anger dropped from Lantano Garawashi's face in an instant. This was a man, Kyler saw, of sudden passions, unpredictable, intense, dangerous. Garawashi drew a white handkerchief and reverently wiped Coracolestus clean of Kyler's blood. He sheathed the blade of heaven.
I will not kill you today, Don Kyler. Peace, rest with your blade. In 10 years, you will be full in your prime. Let's meet then in Ainu and fight before the royal court. Masters such as we deserve to fight with minstrels and maidens and lesser masters in attendance. Should you win, you may have all that's mine, including the holy blade. Should I win, at least you will have had 10 years of life and glory, huh? Yes, it'll be an event anticipated for a decade and retold for 1,000.
You tell me, if I promised you that I was going to get something for you, would you want it now or in 10 years?
If you try now, you'll die. In 10 years, you'll have a chance.
A month ago, Kyler had one goal. To convince his girlfriend Aline that 18 years as a virgin was quite enough. Then Jarl had been murdered while delivering the news that Logan Geyer was trapped in his own dungeon. Kyler's loyalties to the living and the dead had given him 2 new goals that had cost him the first. He'd abandoned Aline, as he'd sworn he wouldn't, in order to save Logan and avenge Jarl by killing the God King. It had cost him an arm, a magical bond to the beautiful disaster named V. Savari, and an oath to steal Garawashi's blade. Now all Kyler wanted was to make sure his sacrifices hadn't been for nothing, and then to go make things right with Aline. As if to punish him for his faithlessness, he now imagined her saying,
"An oath that you only keep when it's convenient isn't an oath at all."
"I can't put it off. Sorry."
"Oh, it's a matter of honor, yes. I understand. That is a
big one!"
Turned and all he could see was a hole tearing in space 10 paces away, and through it, hell and rushing fire cracked skin. In the forest, a big-nosed, big-eared Birdmeister was laughing.
Peace. You're different, half-man.
Hopper was a tall, lean, white-haired old eunuch who was training Dorian. Half-man, he reminded himself. Hopper handed him a pot.
What do you mean?
Two sheets.
Hopper handed Half-man two more chamber pots. Half-man emptied half of the piss into each, swished it around, and emptied the pots into an enormous clay jar set in a wicker frame.
A piece for every two sheets. The rest of the pieces go last. They're easy. You get a puke or a slippery, you use two pieces on those. No one wants to smell that all day.
Half-man thought Hopper wasn't going to answer him, but after they finished emptying the pots into the enormous clay jars, six of them today, it meant one more trip for Half-man than usual, Hopper paused.
I don't know. Look at you, how you sit all straight. Don't forget yourself. A puke. How the girls manage to nick wine is beyond me. If you do, well...
Hopper lifted his sandal-clad feet one at a time and wiggled his big toes. Those two toes were all he had left. He'd been caught teaching the bored women of the harem a dance, he said, and the only reason he'd been let off so easily was because Zurga liked him, and the dance hadn't involved touching or speaking to the women. Other eunuchs, Hopper said, were killed for less.
22 years since my little dance. 22 years I've been with the chamber pots, and I'll stay with them till I die. Now help me with the empties. You remember the process?
One clean water rinses 10 pieces or 4 sheets.
Bright one, you. Help me rinse the first 40, then you can take the pots out.
They worked together in silence. Half-man had made no progress finding the woman who would be his wife. The Citadel held 2 separate harems, and several women were kept apart from either one. Half-man had been assigned to the common harem. More than 100 of Gareth Ursul's wives and concubines lived here. Wives were the women who had produced sons. Concubines, those who had produced either daughters or nothing, which were considered equivalent. Given that Gareth Ursul had to be near 60, all of the women were surprisingly young. No one ever said what happened to the old wives. Each day as he gathered the chamber pots from the concubines' rooms, Half-Man stole glances at the women. The first thing he noticed was that they were always fully clothed. Not only was the God King out of the city, but winter was coming. With no possibility of being asked to serve anytime soon, some of the women didn't even bother brushing their hair or changing out of their bedclothes. Though there seemed to be a form of social censure that kept anyone from slipping too far.
They used to sit there all winter, half naked and made up like fertility whores, huddled around the fires and shivering like puppies in the snow. Now, we give them a signal when His Holiness is on his way. And just wait till you see it. You've never seen anyone move so fast. Or if one of them's called for by name, every last one of the others will descend on her. Kali's blood. You can't even see her for a good 5 minutes. Then, when she comes out of that circle, you'd swear they traded her for the goddess herself. Much as they hate each other and scheme and gossip, when the God King calls, they help each other. It's one thing to gossip and lie about a woman, but none of them wants to be the reason a girl gets sent to the Eightlings.
Dorian's stomach turned. So they knew. Of course they knew. Dorian's seat class had been taught flaying on a disrespectful concubine. Dorian, as the first of the class, had been assigned her face. He remembered his pride as he had presented it to his tutor, Nefdada, whole, even the eyelids and eyelashes intact. The 10-year-old Dorian had worn that face to dinner as a mask, making japes with his seed class while Neff smiled encouragement. God help him. He had done even worse things. What was he doing here? This place was sick. How could a people tolerate this? How could they worship a goddess that delighted in suffering? Dorian sometimes believed the countries had the kind of leaders they deserved. What did that say about Kalidor? With its tribalism and endemic corruption held in check only by its deep fear of the men who styled themselves its god kings, what did it say about Dorian? This was his people, his country, his culture, and once his birthright. He, Dorian Ursul, had survived. He demolished his seed class one at a time, pitting brother against brother, until only he survived. He'd accomplished his Urdthan, his harrowing, and shown himself worthy to be called the God King's son and heir. This, all of this, could have been his. And he didn't miss it for a second. He loved many things about Kalidor. The music, the dances, the hospitality of its poor, its men who laughed or cried freely, and its women who would wail and keen over their dead where Southron stood silent like they didn't care. Dorian loved their zoomorphic art, the wild woad tattoos of the lowland tribes, the cool blue-eyed maidens with their milk-white skin and fierce tempers. He loved 100 things about his people, but sometimes he wondered if the world wouldn't be a better place if the sea swept in and drowned them all. As sacrifices for abundant livestock, how many of those blue-eyed girls had laid their mewling firstborn sons on Kali pyres? For abundant crops, how many of those expressive men had caged their aged fathers in wicker coffins and watched them drown slowly in bogs? They wept as they did murder, but they did it.
Hey, you're thinking. Don't. It's no good here. You work hard, you don't have to think. Got it?
Halfman nodded.
Then let's strap this on, and you can work.
Together they strapped the wicker basket to Halfman's back. There were thongs that wrapped around each shoulder and his hips to help him bear the great weight of the clay pot full of sewage. Hopper promised to have another pot ready by the time Halfman got back. Halfman trudged through the cold basalt hallways. It was always dark in the slaves' passages, with only enough torches burning so the slaves could avoid colliding.
I'm tired of banging toothless slaves. I hear the new girl's in the Tiger Tower. They say she's beautiful.
Tavi! You can't call it that!
Bertold Ursul was Dorian's great-grandfather, and the man had gone mad, believing he could ascend to heaven if he built a tower high enough and decorated it solely with Harani sword-toothed tigers. His madness embarrassed Gareth Ursul, so he'd forbidden the tower to be called anything but Bertold's tower. Dorian stopped. There was a torch at the intersection and no way he could retreat without being noticed. The Aethlings, for no one else spoke with such arrogance, were coming toward him. There was no escape. Then he remembered. He was half-man now, a eunuch slave. So he slouched and prayed that he was invisible.
I talk how I please.
The pair came into the intersection just as Halfman did. Halfman stopped, stepped aside, and averted his eyes. Tavi was a classic Aethling. Good-looking, if with a hawkish nose, well-groomed, well-dressed, an aura of command, and the stench of great power, despite being barely 15 years old. Halfman couldn't help but size him up instantly. This one would be the first of his seed class. This would have been one Dorian would have tried to kill early. Too arrogant, though. Tavi was the kind who needed to brag. He would never make it through his Urdthan.
And I can fuck who I please, too.
Tavi looked down at each of the halls as if lost. His indecision froze Halfman in place. He couldn't move without possibly moving into the Aethling's pass.
Besides, the harems are too closely guarded. But the Tiger Tower's just got two dreads at the bottom. And her deaf-mute eunuchs.
He'll kill you!
The other Aethling didn't look pleased to be having this conversation in front of Halfman.
Who's gonna tell him? The girl? So he'll kill her too? Fuck! Where are we? We've been walking this way for 10 minutes. All these holes look the same.
I said we should have gone the other way!
Shut up, Rivik! You!
Dali pointed to Halfman. Halfman flinched as a slave would.
Kali! You stink! Which way is it to the kitchens?
Halfman reluctantly pointed back the way the Aethlings had come.
Damn it, how far?
Halfman would have found some other way to answer, but Dorian couldn't help himself.
About 10 minutes.
The wicker splintered and the clay pot shattered, geysering human waste over Half-Man and the wall behind him.
Oh, we've got to remember this next time we're bored. Callie's tits, it reeks! Imagine if we could break one of those pots in Drave's room.
The Aethlings left Half-Man on the floor, wiping ooze from his face. It was 5 minutes before he stood up, but when he did, it was with alacrity. In the fear and in the miming of fear, he had almost missed it. The newest concubine could only be one woman. His future wife was at the top of Bertold's tower, and she was in danger.